mind, the chances were 1,000 to 1 that we would be working with the Americans rather than with Great Britain. And it was quite obvious that the United States was going to become the power in the West, no question about it. So therefore, all of our thinking began to go around towards working with the United States rather than with the UK, which had been the traditional Canadian approach militarily, which was really a throwback to World War I, where we used British equipment, mm-hmm. where we were associated with the British until we built up our own corps and so right. forth. But it was always tie-in with Great Britain. And that, of course, historically is because so many of the, 8 million people, I suppose, who were in Canada when World War I broke out, I suppose 7 million of them were Brits.
Yeah.
So that when the call to the colors came, then all they were doing was really going home to fight for home and country.
Yeah.
That's really all it was. They weren't Canadians in the true sense of the word. They had most of them. My own father, who came out in 1912, was one of several hundred thousand who came out to Canada in that time period. And Dad was, when the World War I came along, hell, he was no Canadian. He was an Englishman.
Yeah.
And so that tie was there. By the end of World War II, though, that whole philosophy had changed somewhat.
Yeah,
and certainly in the immediate post-war, yeah. World War II period, in the 50s, all of our studies and plans were now directed to work with the United States, which in part was also due to the Mackenzie-King Roosevelt meeting and the formation of the Permanent Joint Board on Defense, which did an enormous amount of work during the war and really brought the Canadian and American forces very close together, much closer than the Canadian forces were to any other organization. Because here we were working at both the political and the military level as equal partners. And the Brits never did look on Canada as an equal partner during World War II. Canada was always looked on as that colonial force who would provide manpower and, as happened, raw resources to help Great Britain. But the PJBD, which came into being in 1939, worked at both, and the important thing was at the political level, not just the military level, the political level, as equal partners. So that when the war came, the Americans looked on Canada as an equal partner, equal in the sense of a point of view or a vote, if you will, not equal in the sense of productivity.
Productivity or strength.
But in quality,
yep.
Certainly in quality and in terms of a vote. And the PJBD, one of the great things that happened, I think, historically, from a military point of view after the war, was that the PJBD continued. And there was some question as to whether it should continue. But it was decided that it would. And not only that, but during the history of the PJBD, it came up several times as to whether it should be continued or not. But each time, the decision was made, and it had to be made at the political level. It was not a military decision. It was made at the political level, that it was a good thing. Even in the times when everybody was down on the military, it was still decided that it should continue.
Yeah.
And we always did, and the Americans always did, appoint extremely capable men to be the chairman. You know, it's a dual chairmanship type
right.
of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And always extremely capable people. I was with, again, coming a little later, PJBD, but my experience with those people was superb, absolutely superb. Well, that relationship, again, had a big influence on our thinking to go towards the United States.
Even you weren't going to be influenced by Article 2 of NATO and Pearson's big desire
no.
to this North Atlantic.
No, Pearson
had nothing to do with
Pearson was at that time an ambassador in Washington, I suppose, or something like
that.
Well,
okay, that's earlier, but I'm saying, I'm talking now when we're talking about planes and buying planes in the 50s. Now Pearson's Secretary of State for External Affairs.
Yes.
He's pushing NATO
Article
2, and he's, you know, around the world making friends with everybody. And
no, that was not, didn't have any impact at all.
Did not bother you people at all?
Not a bit.
You were after,
not
was
not
the best plane? Was it strictly on
we,
the plane? Or
yes,
was it the
absolutely.
Best American
no,
plane?
No, 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 it was, well, at that time the Americans had the best planes. There was no two ways about the Sabre. What did the Brits have? I suppose about that time they still only had the Meteor, and there was no question in between the Sabre and the Meteor. The Sabre, hell, the Sabre was undoubtedly the best plane that was available at that time. And when the Air Division equipped with Sabres, and when we got our 12 squadrons over there, the let's see, he was an Air Chief Marshal at that time, Sir Basil Embry, made the comment And he was commander-in-chief of the 4th ATAF. No, I'm sorry. It was bigger than that. He was commander-in-chief of the Air Forces, Central Forces Air. And he made the comment at one of the big meetings that the number one Air Division is the jewel in his crown. And without it, he'd be dead. And it was true. It was the Air Division, the 12 squadrons, that really provided the punch to the air defense, even above the Americans and way above the Brits. And not only that, but they kept improving the engine in the thing until they got to the Mark 6. And the Mark 6 was an absolutely superb airplane that could run rings around anything. And the Air Division boys became very cocky. They would take on anything in Europe in a dogfight. Didn't even remember where it came from. And without any hesitation, because they knew they had an airplane that no one could touch. And it was. So, in terms of quality, there was no doubt about it. The Sabre was the best thing. Now, the design of the CF-100 was along the same lines. The CF-100 kind of came out of the, came out of that transport. Wasn't it about that time that the first jet transport was built and then it was knocked on the head? What the hell was it called? The C-100, I guess it was, or something. We only made one or two of them. And it was made by Avro's in Toronto, and it was a bloody way ahead of its time. It was about 10 years ahead of its time. It never got into production. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the exact designation that was given to the bird, but it was a first-class mm-hmm. bird. Well, the CF-100 came along, and it was really almost a follow-on. The experience had begun to develop in producing a civilian jet transport. And it, like happened with the 105 later, it got knocked on the head when it should have gone ahead.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of experience built up. So that experience then was put to work to design, for the first time, a Canadian airplane. Not a copy, mm-hmm. a Canadian airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the CF-100. And that was a completely designed, the components, of course. We had to buy components. We didn't have the depth to start mm-hmm. designing radars, or fire control systems, or missiles, although that came along a little later mm-hmm. when we got to the 105. But at that time, the engine was the Arenda engine, see, which was what had been in the Sabre 6.
Mm-hmm.
And the airframe was a completely Canadian design. So that we had, in terms of best, there was the whole purpose of going for a Canadian all-weather fighter was that we felt that we could build what we wanted to our specifications and have the best in the
this
world.
Is coming up for the Arrow, is that?
Well, it comes on up for the Arrow, yes.
Up to the Arrow itself. Now, is there
I want to cover the Arrow because it happened.
I know. I'm not trying to push you along there. What I guess I'm trying to get at now is, though, is that when you're looking at these planes at this particular point, we're talking 52, 53, 54 in there, with the Arrow is in the background, like, are these looked as interim planes until we can design this?
Yes, the Arrow was to be the ne plus ultra. Because here again, the operational requirement and the specifications written for the Arrow were literally a no-holds-barred proposition. We were to get the absolute best. For the first time, we were to design and build an airplane and all the systems to meet the Canadian environmental requirement, whereas before there had been compromises.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in the 100, we didn't like the radar. The radar didn't have the range that we wanted, but it was a question of how big was the dish and what was available on the market to fit in with the timing of the thing. And all these lead time factors are terribly important when you're talking about construction of airplanes,
certainly,
and particularly components.
Loaded to design.
Well, with the Arrow came along, and it was while I was ALP, and of course everyone was just really thrilled with that one, because it was to be a new engine, a new airframe, a new fire control system, a new radar, and a new weapon, which was to be the Velvet Glove missile. In other words, the first time we were getting into the missile business, the rockets had come along, but not missiles.
Mm-hmm.
An electronically guided missile, or a homing missile. as the Velvet Glove was. So all of a sudden, here we are right in the forefront in development, in R&D, with an engine, an airframe, a radar, a fire control system, and a weapon. Completely new weapon. And the kicker to the whole thing was that all five had to be perfect if the whole was going to work. And if any one fall flat in its face and the other four were useless, no good to you. Well, as it worked out, everything began to fall into place. And there was only one hiccup that I recall, and that was on the radar. We designed the radar, and then there was a change in the specification. The operational people thought that it should be changed slightly, and it meant a bigger dish. And a bigger dish, of course, means really redesigning the whole of the nose of the airplane, because all you got to do is increase your dish by 1 inch, and you've got a major change. And here we were talking, I think we were talking about a dish that was something like an increase of about 4 inches. Well, that was a real hiccup. it was an operational requirement. It just meant greater range, greater definition, and the idea being that with an all-weather fighter flying up in the Arctic, you wanted the maximum range, and if it was an unknown, you could pick him up at 100 miles and something like that, and then home in on him. And those were the kind of specifications we were talking about in those days, not the AI when we'd wound up the war. An AI, mm-hmm. if you pick up something at 4 or 5 miles, you were doing extremely well.
Now, this is all part of your duties in logistics,
yes.
that you're not making the decision for what to go for yet.
No.
When the decision is made itself,
well,
you
at that
have
time,
to coordinate a lot of these things.
Oh, hell yes. I had to coordinate a lot of the aero program. Now,
when does the aero program start, I guess? I'm sorry.
Well, I can't remember.
I
can't remember when it actually got started. See, I was in logistics plans from 52...
to 55.
To 55. Well, yes, to the end of 55. So I was there 3 years. So it would be in my last year there when the horrendous decision, I suppose it would be in 55 when the horrendous decision was taken on the Arrow. Because I know that it was my, as far as I was concerned, the big job I had when I was ALP was the Arrow. The others, all the other programs that I coordinated on an annual basis. Before I get onto the Arrow and get too deep into it, I should perhaps explain a bit more on my functions. Aside from coordinating from a planning point of view all the various logistics programs, I also was responsible for putting together the budget, the estimates for the logistics side of the house. So that I had to go around to all of the various shops and get their estimates from them for the coming fiscal year, and then go through a screening process. And when I was satisfied that the funds were right, then I put it all together into a logistics budget, which then went into the financial people, and they then put the whole thing together, and then we went through the second screening process, where all the monies now for the Air Force are all in the one pot, or on the one piece of paper. And as always, you're $100 million too much now. Where the hell is $100 million going to be chopped out of your estimates?
Yeah.
So then I would have to go and defend, along with AMTS.
Did you follow the Army practice of... or the so-called Army practice of doubling up your estimates?
No. There was no point.
No,
there was no point. Because if you did that, then it meant that somewhere else, something that you wouldn't be able to put something in your estimates. There was no point in doing it. That's a fallacy, actually, because what happens is that when you're making up your estimates, you've got X number of things and you put them in priority. Now, what you try and do is you try and squeeze your top priority one as finely as you can so that you can include your bottom priority one, because you still need it. If you can't squeeze it, then your bottom one's going to get dropped.
You have your overall, but you're sort of given an overall how much you can expect.
Yes. Oh, yes. That's a normal practice in government.
Okay.
It'd be about December when Treasury Board would come out and say, all right, DND, you can have X millions in next year's budget, and Air Force, your portion of that would be X amount. So then we knew where we stood. But we were still putting together the estimates. We didn't know what the final sum would be, and it was about December. before we knew what the total would be for the for the Air Force as a whole, and that would include pay and allowances and all the logistics, pension fund, everything would be thrown into the pot, and then that was when you began to have to cut. Well, the time taken to put the estimate together was enormous. That required a lot of time, and there were many, many occasions when it was my job as ALP to make a decision, an arbitrary decision. And as I was screening, I used to do it, and I used to always keep a record, because I always told AMTS what I had done, because I worked directly for him as a group captain, although there were many air commoners around who were head of the various shops. Mm-hmm. I had direct entree to AMTS. He was my boss. So I could tell an air commoner, I can't accept that, and I would arbitrarily chop, but I'd always go and tell AMTS I'd done it, so that he would know what decision I had made. And in that way, we worked very closely together, and it worked well.
Your ranking there is, you're still a group captain.
That's right, still a group captain, yes, but with a lot of air commodores who are heading up all the various elements in the logistics organization. Well, the time it took to put the estimate together was enormous. It was a very complicated affair. The screening took a lot of time, and it was always a great relief when estimates were finally written. A lot of night work. You'd work until 10 or 11 o'clock at night, particularly when you got down to the short strokes and the deadline was coming up. And it was then that some hard decisions had to be made, and more often the final big policy decisions had to go before Air Council. Mm-hmm. And they'd have a big hassle, and then a decision would be taken, all right, this is what gets the chop. Because the other must have priority. And so on.
Yeah. I find this really interesting in that I was reading Hansard the other day, and you hear about Brooke Flaxman, he came out in 1951 with this whole new program, this $5 billion, and it would seem that the forces were going to have virtually and anything they wanted, anything they could envision, and the and understandably it's Hansard, of course, but the impression being that there wasn't any chopping. What the impression is, and they're talking here in 1951 of 40 regular and reserve squadrons with 3,000 aircraft.
That's what he was talking about.
That
never got off the ground. And initially, you're right. At the time, there was no real shortage of money for capital programs. If we decided, then that was why there was no problem in picking the best airplane. But it didn't necessarily follow that we could number one, have all the money we needed for construction. And there were other constricting factors, too, in this damn thing. Let's take construction. One of the great problems that our engineers had was that the bloody industry couldn't spend that kind of money. And we didn't know what their limits were. After all, the rest of the country was expanding. Edmonton was taking off. Toronto was taking off. And we had to compete for that labor force or that engineering talent. And there was a limit to how much we could spend, and that was a factor. And while there was lots of money, there was never any point in asking for more money than you needed. And as it happened in those years, we always went to bed at the end of the fiscal year with unspent funds, as much as $100 to $200 million, which, of course, today would be considered just bloody bad management. In those days, it was lack of experience in being able to judge just how much industry could spend. Mm-hmm. But engineers, for example, in the screening process, swearing on a stack of Bibles that there was no doubt that the money that they were asking for could be spent by the industry, and then finding out about halfway through the year, they'd come in rather sheepishly when the monthly progress on expenditures was coming out to say, sorry, we it looks as if we're going to have slippage. And of course, right away, quick, there's $50 million down the drain in terms of the department. Because at the end of the fiscal year, all your money lapses if it isn't spent. It just lapses. You don't get it. You have to start all over again.
The industry couldn't produce.
That's right.
Today, of course, seems
to be. Oh, yes. Oh, no, today, the industry would just love to have it, and particularly the construction industry. But when you had bases being built, for example, we had, you get major bases, Greenwood. Let's just take the ones where we had the big hangars. Greenwood, Summerside, Trenton, Winnipeg, Edmonton. Now, just in those those bases alone, I suppose we must have been spending probably some in the neighborhood of about $40 million a year. And that was a lot of money when you were competing against what was going on elsewhere in Canada at the time. So there was no trouble in getting money for capital programs, but there was also always a problem of getting down into the nitty-gritty, because Treasury Board still had a responsibility for screening all expenditures, and there was no point in going before them if you didn't have a good case. Otherwise, they'd throw it out. Mm-hmm. And what is worse, and this was the one thing that we, the Air Force, learned very quickly and it benefited from, the integrity of the estimates. When the Air Force went before Treasury Board, very, very seldom were they able to find a flaw in the estimates. So this integrity, this relationship, this respect built up between Treasury Board and the Air Force, which was great. Because when panics did happen, and there was need for a rapid approval of some program in an awful hurry, Treasury Board officials would say, all right, we'll have to go into it in detail later, but it's obvious you need it. We'll accept it, and we'll approve it. And that would be it. Literally, it would be almost, I'll say, Doug Smith's word. Doug Smith would say, we need it. And the Treasury Board official who responsible would say, if you say you need it, I'll go along with you. But we'll go into it later. And then he'd sign off on the thing and go to before the board and we'd get approval back the next day or something like that. Mm-hmm. Great. Just great. But the reason why that relationship evolved was because of the work that went into the preparation of the estimates. So they were good, and no one could find fault with them. Even though Treasury Board also had no feel for what was happening in the country, and these under expenditures are going to bed with money. No one, I don't think anyone could have really come up with accurate estimates in those day and age. We were spending large sums of money, and they were increasing every year. Mm-hmm. And in a country that was still very small, and was trying to learn how to spend those kind of funds, because we hadn't even done that during the war. In the war, we had spent money in other ways by buying equipment from someone else.
That's right.
And it took a long time to get things like the aircraft program really cranked up in Canada. Mm-hmm. And here we were trying to do it in an awful hurry. And all that experience during the war had been dissipated. A lot of those dollar-a-year men had gone back to their various businesses, and the government now had no dollar-a-year type of organization. It was bring somebody in and pay him. He had to be a deputy minister or an assistant deputy minister or a politician. So it was an entirely different ballgame. We're talking about peacetime as opposed to a wartime condition.
Yeah. Everything just happened really fast. I mean, the way you're talking about it now.
It's it did. And in the space of 3 years, I started to think how much money I coordinated over a in a 3 year period, in terms of expenditures just on logistics, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, and that basically was my function. Now, one of the responsibilities was the Arrow.
I've got a. Be half a distance away at 11 o'clock.
Right.
And I think the Arrow is a damn good place to.
Okay, because the Arrow is a.
It's a story in itself. Right. Have you heard, incidentally, and I heard about a year ago, that someone was writing a book on the Arrow?
I hadn't heard.
I hadn't.
I would think anybody who would write it would have to be somebody in the industry.
Yeah.
Who'd have to do it.
Yeah.
I think there aren't very many people around who know the full story on the Arrow. There aren't many. It was handled. Well, maybe I better not go into it. Maybe we'll leave it until we go into it. Because if I get launched, it's a long story. Long story. It needs a lot of build up. Yet it's a very simple one. In the end, it's a very simple one.
Yeah. Money.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dollars.
Right. 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 But how we got there is what is.
And I can't think of any one item, Reg, myself, where even today there's more bitterness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Over the cancellation.
Yeah.
I suppose that and the Canadian flag.
Well, it's funny, of course, I don't feel that way about it, and the reason, I suppose, is very simple. I was the one that had to make the recommendation to cancel it, so I was very au fait, you see, with what was going on.
I wouldn't go shouting that from the roof.
Grandma
wouldn't want to talk.
That's why I mean when it's a long story, but it's a simple one in the final analysis.
Yeah. Where were you living, incidentally, in Ottawa at this time, on your second trip?
Let's see. We were still living in the West End. No, I'm sorry. No, we were living up just off the canal near Dallas Lake.
Oh, yeah.
Because when I came back from Edmonton, got a house there, and we stayed there until 1955 when I went over to the Imperial Defence College in London, and so that's when where we were living then. And but again, back to those bloody winters. And also during that time, yeah, television was just coming in too.
That's right.
That was when we had our first television. It was at that time.
Yeah. Any children by this time?
Yes. Let's see. Susan was born here. Then we had Deborah in Ottawa, and then John was born in Edmonton. So we had our. By the time we moved back to 52, when we moved back to Ottawa, or I went to ALP, we had three children at that time.
Yeah.
Yes. Although John was quite small, John born in Edmonton.
Yeah.
Did your salary things? Wondering, did your salary, because we had a fairly high rank, of course, but did your salary not, was, how should I put this, did the Department of National Defense and the Air Force keep up with crime?
No, were you way behind?
Or?
Oh, way behind.
At that time,
absolutely. As a matter of fact, I think I've got some old figures. Maybe I should dig them out sometime. Old income tax returns. But as I recall, my pay as a wing commander, which would be when I was in, 46, 47 in that time period, I think my take-home pay was about $300 a month. And then as a group captain, I doubt if my take-home pay, and this is now in 52, I doubt if my take-home pay was... $500 a month.
That's what I mean.
No. I'm trying to remember what I got when I was called out as a lieutenant in 1951. Yeah. And I suppose it'd be around the $200 mark.
Yes, it was very low. No, you were scratching. And the airmen, or the people at lower ranks, were having a very tough time.
Yeah.
Oh, extremely tough time.
You have to remember that at those times you could still get a nut bar for 5 minutes.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I know. I was just thinking, though, that Ottawa probably is not the cheapest place in Canada to live, let alone with three kids.
Edmonton was the worst. Edmonton was the worst because everything was taking fire. Oh, yes. Renting.
Boomtown.
Yeah, boomtown. Yeah.
Well, that's okay, sir.